printing declared abolished. Francis I had delighted to gather at his court men of letters from every country. But, inspired with zeal to stamp out heresy, this patron of learning issued an edict declaring printing abolished all over France. Francis I's presence won among the many examples on record showing that intellectual culture is not a safeguard against religious intolerance and persecution. The priests demanded that the affront offered to high heaven in the condemnation of the Mass be expiated in blood. January 21, 1535, was fixed upon for the awful ceremonial. Before every door was a lighted torch in honor of the Holy Sacrament. Before daybreak, the procession formed at the palace of the king. The host was carried by the Bishop of Paris under a magnificent canopy, supported by four princes of the blood. After the host walked the king, Francis I on that day wore no crown, nor robe of state. At every altar he bowed in humiliation, not for the vices that defiled his soul, nor the innocent blood that stained his hands, but for the deadly sin of his subjects who had dared to condemn the Mass. In the great hall of the bishop's palace the monarch appeared and in words of moving eloquence bewailed the crime, the blasphemy, the day of sorrow and disgrace, that had come upon the nation. And he called upon every loyal subject to aid in the extirpation of the pestilent heresy that threatened France with ruin. Tears choked his utterance, and the whole assembly wept, with one accord exclaiming, "We will live and die for the Catholic religion." The grace that bringeth salvation had appeared, but France, illuminated by its radiance, had turned away, choosing darkness rather than light. They had called evil good, and good evil, till they had fallen victims to their willful self-deception. The light that would have saved them from deception, from staining their souls with blood guiltiness, they had willfully rejected. Again the procession formed. At short distances scaffolds had been erected on which certain Protestant Christians were to be burned alive, and it was arranged that the faggot should be lighted at the moment the king approached, and that the procession should halt to witness the execution. There was no wavering on the part of the victims. On being urged to recant, one answered, "I only believe in what the prophets and the apostles formerly preached, and what all the company of saints believed. My faith has a confidence in God which will resist all the powers of hell." Upon reaching the palace, the crowd dispersed and the king and the prelates withdrew, congratulating themselves that the work would be continued to the complete destruction of heresy. The gospel of peace which France rejected was to be too surely rooted out, and terrible would be the results. On January 21, 1793, another procession passed through the streets of Paris. Again the king was the chief figure, again there were tumult and shouting, again there was heard the cry for more victims, again there were black scaffolds, and again the scenes of the day were closed by horrid executions. Louis XVI, struggling hand to hand with his jailers and executioners, was dragged forward to the block, and there held down by main force till the axe had fallen, and his dissevered head rolled on the scaffold. Near the same spot 2,800 human beings perished by the guillotine. The Reformation had presented to the world an open Bible. Infinite love had unfolded to men the principles of heaven. When France rejected the gift of heaven, she sowed seeds of ruin. The inevitable outworking of cause and effect resulted in the revolution and the reign of terror. The bold and ardent Farel had been forced to flee from the land of his birth to Switzerland. Yet he continued to exert a decided influence upon the reform in France. With the assistance of other exiles, the writings of the German reformers were translated into French and together with the French Bible were printed in large quantities. By colporteurs these works were sold extensively in France. Farel entered upon his work in Switzerland in the humble guise of a schoolmaster, cautiously introducing the truths of the Bible. Some believed, but the priests came forward to stop the work, and superstitious people were roused to oppose it. "That cannot be the gospel of Christ," urged the priests, "seeing the preaching of it does not bring peace, but war." From village to village he went, enduring hunger, cold, and weariness, and everywhere in peril of his life. He preached in the marketplace, in the churches, sometimes in the pulpits of the cathedrals. More than once he was beaten almost to death. Yet he pressed forward. One after another he saw towns and cities which had been strongholds of popery opening their gates to the gospel. Farrell had desired to plant the Protestant standard in Geneva. If this city could be won, it would be a center for the Reformation in France, Switzerland, and Italy. Many of the surrounding towns and hamlets had been gained. With a single companion he entered Geneva. But only two sermons was he permitted to preach. The priests summoned him before an ecclesiastical council, to which they came with arms concealed under their robes, determined to take his life. A furious mob was gathered to make sure of his death if he should escape the council. The presence of magistrates and an armed force, however, saved him. Early next morning he was conducted across the lake to a place of safety. Thus ended his first effort to evangelize Geneva. For the next trial a lowlier instrument was chosen, a young man so humble in appearance that he was coldly treated even by the professed friends of reform. But what could such a one do where Farrell had been rejected? God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty.